Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. We have a guest with us today is one of the best-known economists, Mike, in the country. He's a director of the Center for Economic Policy Research. There are so many, Mike was saying, there's so many research institutes with similar names that we've got to get this one. Yet I will say, folks, it is online. You can find CEPR, C-E-P-R. And you can Dean Baker's has on Twitter from regular interesting work, and so he's very, very accessible. All right,
you can catch him on a lot of talk shows and whatnot. So we're going to talk about some really heavy duty economic stuff this morning, because certainly everybody's head is there. Certainly mine is.
He's a senior economist at this institute and just widely written and stuff. We talked to him years ago. He was really nice to come on the show back when we were 15 minutes long.
That's a while
instead
back.
Instead of 45 minutes. All right, let's get to the main question, which is here we are. And what has been the impact? I mean, we know we can watch Donald Trump juggle everything around with the handling of the public health aspect of the COVID, but how has he handled the economic aspect of it?
Well, the economic and public health aspects are integrally linked, because the whole point, the reason why we saw this huge fall off in the economy in the second quarter, it actually even began in the first quarter, we had a sharp fall off based on the shutdowns beginning in March. But we were deliberately shutting down the economy. I mean, so it's that was policy. So the fact that we saw a big fall off, 32.9% in GDP, that's an annualized rate, by the way. So the economy didn't fall 32.9% in the second quarter. Divide that by four, so it fell roughly 8%. But that's still huge. It's a huge fall off. But that was because we deliberately shut down the economy. We didn't want people to go out more than necessary. We didn't want them going to restaurants and bars and movies. All these things were shut down. Some of them are, of course, still shut down. So that's the public health and economic aspect going together. As a matter of public health, we had to keep people from going to work, keep people from shopping, doing things they otherwise would have done. And, of course, that came with a huge economic price. So seeing the big fall off in the second quarter, I would not blame Trump for, in the sense that I don't think that was a fault. We might have, arguably, we perhaps should have had a bigger fall off because we should have had longer shutdowns. This was the story. We need to shut down large segments of the economy to get the pandemic under control.
Let me interrupt for a second and say that Europe shut down 95% of their economy, and what I heard is the USA only shut down 50% of their economy.
Yeah, well, I don't know if 95%, I think it varies some country by country,
sure.
But they had more extreme shutdowns. So in a number of the countries, I know for certain in Italy and France and Spain, you literally could not leave your house or apartment without permission, in a sense. You had to, what you would do, the way they would do it in these countries was you would print out, you would say, I'm going to the grocery store to get my groceries. And you would, there was an agency that this is all online, and you would say, this is for a trip to the grocery store. I assume you'd have to give, which store, and you'd print that out. And then if someone on the street saw you, a police officer saw you, you'd go, here, this is what I'm doing. And if you didn't have that, you'd face a fine and possibly jail if you did that enough, if you violated the rules enough. So they were very serious about keeping people in place.
And, same in Germany, too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this is true. I'm mentioning those three because, I'm familiar with exactly what happened there. In Germany, I suspected something similar. But the point was they got their infection rates way down. So their infection rates now, and this is adjusting for populations, so I'm not trying to play games, they're about 1/20th of what they are in the U.S. So this has allowed these countries to reopen. They still have a lot of precautions in place. They're still requiring or at least encouraging people to wear masks. There's still some things that aren't open. I think in most of these countries you still can't go into a bar, at least an inside bar. So there's still precautions in place. But for the most part, their economies are up and running now. We're not in a position to do that, and it's just kind of mind-boggling to me. So if you look at where we are today compared to where we were in April or March when we put the shutdowns in place, if you pull out New York and New Jersey, because those states were very, very badly hit in those months, if you pull those out, we had 20,000 infections a day or thereabout in the rest of the country. Currently, New York and New Jersey are very much under control. We could pull them out. We're talking about over 60,000 infections a day in the rest of the country. So we haven't brought our virus, our infection rates down. The rest of the world did. They took advantage of these shutdowns to make sure that they had things under control. They were able to reopen. They now monitor people when there's infections. They find out who they were seeing, who they'd been around, and they warn those people. They ask them to quarantine themselves. So they took it seriously, and as a result of that, their economies are now largely up and running. Because we're still in a situation where the pandemic is totally out of control, we can't do that. And it doesn't make sense to pretend we can. So we had Donald Trump yelling about how we have to open the schools. Well, it would be great to open the schools, but we're really not prepared to do that, at least in most parts of the country. So we didn't take the steps that were necessary. We took half steps. Some states, New York did a great job, New Jersey did a great job, you can point to some others, they were effective in having a strong enough shutdown long enough that they were able to bring their infection rates under control. I should also add, I mean, Donald Trump tried to undermine that. He sponsored these protests, in some cases armed protests. I spent a number of years in Michigan in grad school, so I follow there. They had armed protesters go down to their capital threatening their governor, Mr. Law and Order. Trump likes to call himself President of Law and Order. He apparently didn't care about that, but they were saying, okay, you have to open up the state. And she stuck to her bad choice of words. I was going to say stuck to her guns, but she held to the principle that we have to get the virus under control, and they did bring their infection rates way, way down. But that was really against everything Donald Trump could do to prevent that. But key point here is if you get your virus, your infection rates down, you could have something closer to a normal economy. But unfortunately, we're nowhere close to that in large parts of the country. Certainly you aren't down there in Arizona. I'm in Utah now, no better situation here.
So we're talking about roughly an infection rate of twice of what it was when we shut down the economy. And yet we're talking about reopening opening the economy and schools. So can somebody explain this to me, I guess?
It really makes zero sense. I mean, I understand the frustration. I'd love to be able to go into a restaurant, have dinner, go out and do a lot of things. I go to the store once a week to pick up groceries. That's it. Other than that, I'm not in contact with anyone. I'm in contact with my wife. You know, we live together. But you know, it's not worth the risk. I personally am in good health, but my wife less so. So it's just I'm not going to be taking a risk like that. So I understand the frustration. Who wouldn't feel the frustration? You know, we get this absurd thing like, oh, some people want to reopen, and then there's people that are being nasty to us or something, saying we can't do this or that, we can't open our schools. There's no one in that category. You'd be nuts to not want people to be able to go into restaurants and do the other things that they want to do in their life. No one wants that, but the point is we're not in a position to allow that because we're just going to spread the virus and it's just going to keep getting worse, and people are dying. It's not a joke.
So people are dreaming of going back to the life we had before, and I can imagine, I lived in New York for many years, people are dreaming of getting back, particularly in some of the eastern cities, sort of cafe life. Young people are deeply involved in going to the gym and going to a bar, commuting doing all this stuff, but we can't do it yet, right? So
it's not really an arguable point. I mean, we have the data here, so it's not like we could look at it and go, oh, it's gone away.
Yeah.
It clearly hasn't. Again, you could point to the success stories. You could point to New York, and they've done a very good job of bringing it under control, and they are more open now, but you still can't go into a bar in New York City, which is smart. I mean, they don't want people to get infected, and they don't want to get the rates back to where they were in March and April.
So what's been the long-term effect on the economy of the virus? It still hasn't played out yet. I think that's a good point that you're making to folks. It hasn't played out yet, but what's been the long-term effect? Because we see all these very scary statistics about what's happening to the GDP, which is the best shorthand measure of the health of the economy we got.
Yeah, I think we're seeing some very, very interesting, and maybe people object to that word because it means job loss, but interesting stories sort of play out here. So what I've been writing about is that we're going to see permanent changes in behavior. Most obviously, we're seeing a lot more telecommuting. So we have people that find they could do their work just fine at home. They don't have to go in the office. A lot of that's going to stay. Some of that will go back, but a lot of that is clearly going to stay. I've come to appreciate in my years doing economics, inertia is a really powerful force. So you tell your boss, oh, I want to telecommute. They tell you to get lost.
Yeah.
But when they see you've been telecommuting for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, and you got all your work done, it's a little harder for them to say that. And bosses generally, I mean, some bosses are jerks for the sake of being jerks, but most of them, they want to get the work done. So if they could get the work done and have the person not come into the office and they don't need as much office space that they have to pay rent on, they're good with that. So a lot of this is going to be permanent. You'll have a lot fewer people commuting into offices. We'll see that in other ways. Universities, I was teaching a course at the University of Utah. My last session was online. Maybe I didn't do that good a job. I don't know. But you're going to see a lot more universities have online courses. I don't think it's the end of physical classrooms. I think they will come back, but I think we will see a lot more people taking courses online. It's more flexible. People could work it around their schedule if they have kids or they're working or doing other things during the day. So I think we'll see a lot more things like that. Even something like doctors, telemedicine. A lot of people weren't able to get into their doctor's offices for regular checkups, or they had issues, so they dealt with that through telemedicine. Now, that's not going to be adequate in all cases, so people will still have to go into a doctor's office. But in some cases, someone's got a bad headache, flu-like symptoms, that might be just fine. They could go online and describe the symptoms, and a doctor could say what they think, and if they're not better after a day or two, they actually come in. But we could deal with a lot of healthcare that way. But the long and short is that we're going to see a lot less commuting in different forms that employed a lot of people. So if you think of people going to downtown offices in New York City, well, to start with, most obviously, you'll need less office space. So all the people who are employed in servicing those offices, cleaning them, other things associated with keeping the offices, maintaining the offices, they aren't going to be needed. But more importantly, of all these people coming into work, well, there's restaurants all over the places. People go to gyms. There's other things that they do before and after work. Of course, if they're going to work every day, they need business clothes. We'll see less purchases of business clothes, haircuts. People still get haircuts, I'm sure, but they might feel less of a need to you know, have their hair look nice every day or whatever. So we're going to see a lot less demand in a wide range of areas. Now, that's going to mean jobs. But the point I've been making is we should really think of this as an increase in productivity, in the sense that these are expenses associated with work. I mean, not to say that people might not enjoy having lunch with their friends at work and that sort of thing, but for the most part, these are expenses that are associated with work, that if we could reduce that, people have to spend less money driving a car in or taking a cab or whatever it might be to get into work. That's a good thing. That frees up resources. And what that means is that we have resources that are available for other purposes, meeting other needs. And the list of needs, I mean, it's a long one, but just at the top of that, we need to do something about climate change. So we're going to need to hire a lot of people to be involved in doing things like putting in solar paneling on roofs or conserving energy conservation equipment in a home, that sort of thing, replacing people. We'll still have people commuting, so if we can get more people taking buses or other forms of mass transit, that will substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a whole range of things we need to do in the way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We also need more child care. That's become very clear in the pandemic. A lot of people found themselves stuck with kids. They didn't have access to regular child care. That's a very big deal, because obviously parents who work or want to work They have to have some place to have their kids cared for their working day.
It has been a child care crisis. It was seriously. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. For the people I talk to, because of the work situation, it has been a child care crisis. We were woefully unprepared for, among many other things. We're talking to Dean Baker of the Center for Economic Policy Research. And I want you to, if you could, when you're ready, to take a look at one of your principles that is early on in a recent article. Here we are arguing about, at least if you watch the national media, about sending people back to work when we need, I believe, your discussion is maintaining the worker at home until such time as that they can go back to work. This isn't the time, I think, is the point you've been making for the last several minutes.
Yeah,
I want to add an observation. I mean, many people have discovered, to their surprise, via Zoom, that there really isn't any need for people to travel from various places to have a meeting. A Zoom meeting works just as well and costs practically nothing.
Yeah, that's, again, going to be one of the long-term changes. As an economist, I don't know how many economics conferences I attended over the years, and sometimes it's fun. You go to this place or that place, and you get to see a city or countryside. So it's not, I'm saying it's the economist I'm getting my trip paid for somewhere, so that could be nice. But that's a lot of money to send me to this place or that. And if we could have the conference over Zoom, of course, that saves a lot of money. So, again, that's a efficiency and, in fact, an increase in productivity that we're likely to see enduring as a result of this crisis. But getting back to the earlier point about we want people to stay at home, we're having this debate in Congress over how to structure, and people often use the term a stimulus package. And the idea of stimulus is you want spending. You want to see the economy expand. And the point I've been making is, no, when we still have the pandemic out of control, we have 60, 70,000 cases a day, we don't want people to go shopping. We don't want them to go to restaurants, to gyms, all these things that they would ordinarily do. I mean, that's great when they could do that. That's not now. So what we have to be thinking about is how could we make sure that people could stay at home, that they could make sure that they could pay their rent, pay for their necessities, and get through this period, which I can't see the future. I mean, I hope it's not until we have a vaccine, because among other things, we don't know when that will be. But that's going to be a while. But so hopefully we could get the pandemic more under control. But as long as it's not under control, we need to do things like have the $600 supplements, weekly supplements to unemployment insurance, to be sure that the people who aren't working, lost their jobs, that they could stay home and pay for their rent, pay the mortgage, pay for the food they need and other necessities. That's what we have to be thinking of. So the idea that we want people to go out and spend, we don't want that now. We might want that down the road, but we don't want that today.
I guess the... What? Go ahead, Klaus.
It seems to me that the likelihood of what you're suggesting, and which obviously makes sense, is not all that likely to pass Congress, particularly the Senate, obviously.
The Republicans are opposed to the $600 a week, which is the major lifeline of people we know here. And the extension of unemployment in this crisis seems like just the most reasonable thing in the world. And yet they're opposed to that. They say if we continue to put in $600 a week more, that people won't go back to work and they'll just sit on their butts and collect their $600. And so we don't want to extend that, they say. They don't want to extend a lot of the medical stuff. It's sort of astonishing.
Yeah, well, I mean, what comes out of the politics, I guess we'll know soon, hopefully soon at least, because obviously this has already expired, so people may not know. So someone is out of work, their $600 supplement, that's expired. And as a practical matter, I don't know how quickly, so even if Congress were to agree this afternoon, how quickly that could be reinstated. I suspect that would vary by state, but people are going to at least miss one of those and quite possibly two, even if they act very, very quickly, which, of course, there's no guarantee they'll do. But getting to this point, so what the Republicans are saying is that they think people are staying at home that this is discouraging people from working. And I guess I'd say, well, that 2 points. One, that's in part true, because that's the point. excuse me. We want people to be able to stay at home and to maintain themselves, to pay their rent and mortgage and get their necessities. We want that. They shouldn't have to go to work, because that's endangering themselves and quite possibly others if they, you know, if it turns out that they're infected. So we want people to have that option. But the other point is, and there's a number of economists who've done good analyses, but I just look at the basic numbers, there's very little evidence that you have employers that can't get people who are willing to work just now. Because we have massive unemployment. There's millions, tens of millions of people, I should say, out of work. And even if, you know, this person or that person or the other person, they want to stay home because they're worried about their health, they're worried about the health of a spouse or maybe a parent, someone else they come in contact with, there's still someone else who's willing to come in and work. So the evidence that employers can't find people, it's just not there. If it were the case that employers really couldn't find people, there's two things we should expect to see. One is a huge increase in job openings. So there's a number of surveys, some by the government, many by private businesses, that monitor job openings. In other words, employers saying, hey, I have this job open. We don't see any big rise in that. In fact, it's way below year-ago levels. So there's not evidence of that. The other is we should be seeing that employers are raising wages, because that's obviously if you need someone to work and you can't find people, well, how do you get them? Well, you raise wages and you'll get people from your competitors. Again, we don't see that. Wage growth, at least insofar as we could measure it through the last, say, 4 months, it's actually slowed. So there's really no evidence to support the case that this is a big problem for employers, that they can't get workers, which, again, not to say that there's not some workers. Maybe the employer had a really good worker and they'd love to have them back, but the worker's saying, hey, my husband or I live with my parents or one of my parents, I don't want to jeopardize their health. So I'm sure there are cases like that, but that doesn't mean that they can't get another person if they're prepared to offer the prevailing wage.
So why are the Republicans arguing this, Dean? Do you think that they're arguing that support, the long-term support, and like the $1,200 checks that went to people, and I know people who are working in businesses where the government is picking up their pay for like the last couple of months. All that is ending, I think. And why oppose that? Is there's not, what you're saying is there's not an economic reason to oppose it.
I don't see an economic reason. I think a lot of it is that for a lot of Republicans, the idea of giving money to people who aren't rich is just painful. I mean, they don't have a problem giving tax cuts to rich people, but most of the people who are getting unemployment insurance, safe bet, they're not rich. So I think for them, it's just, why should we be giving these people money? They're not working. Why should we give them money? And you see that. I mean, that sounds facetious, pernicious. I'm not sure exactly what you'd want to call it. But you look at their behavior over a lot of things. So work requirements for food stamps. Well, we're not giving people that much money on food stamps. The average benefit's, I think, $130 a week. I should double-check that. But it's not a huge handout. So, yes, we don't want people ripping off the government. I agree with them on that. But is this a really big problem? Is this something that we should be spending a lot of time worrying? I mean, we know. I mean, any number of people have studied who's getting food stamps, and the vast majority of people who are getting them are people who genuinely need them. Are there some people who lie? Sure. But how much time would you spend doing that? And what's how much time would you spend monitoring that? What's probably more important is you're harassing everyone. So let's say that 90, 95, maybe it's even higher, but a very high percent of people getting food stamps, they're doing what we want them to do. They're working, they're taking care of a sick family member, a disabled family member. They're doing the things that we think they should be doing. They don't have enough money to put food on the table, so we give them this modest supplement with food stamps. And then we go, okay, but you have to do this, you have to jump through this hoop, that hoop, and how much do you want to harass these people?
Well, exactly. There's millions and millions of people being helped in this corner, and then maybe in that other corner there's a few people that are gaming the system or taking advantage of it. But these millions of people are paying for those few people in the corner, which is quite insane. One of the things that I want to talk about is the coming foreclosure, at least in the right-wing press seems to be ignoring the fact that people don't have any money coming in, and when people don't have any money coming in, they're not going to be able to make their house payments. So we're looking at least the numbers I have seen, far outstripped the numbers in 2008 and certainly the Great Depression. So we're talking massive foreclosure and there's, I don't know, few things in life that are more damaging and demoralizing than having your house taken away from you by the bank. Can you make some comments on the coming foreclosure? Is there a foreclosure mess coming?
Yeah, there certainly is a big issue. Let me just correct. I think I said for food stamp benefits, 130 a week. That probably had some people scratching their heads. It's about 130 a month, just to be clear. So when I was saying it's not a lot of money, it's really not a lot of money.
It's really
not. But in any case, the foreclosure issue is obviously a huge one. So a lot of people, if they've been out of work, they're going to be way behind on their mortgages and have no easy way to make that up. And again, the legislation that passed Congress, the CARES Act back in April, had a moratorium on houses where the government had a role in the financing, which is probably offhand, I don't have a clear number on that, but probably around 25% of mortgages. And they put a foreclosure moratorium into place that I believe ended at the end of last month. So that means they can be foreclosed. Ideally, that will be extended in new legislation. I think Trump has indicated a willingness to extend that. So I think that's a decent chance that it will be extended. But you still run into the issue, okay, at some point that ends, then what happens? And ideally, Congress would put something in to you know, try to, I don't know if you could have a write-down of debt, but something that would allow people to pay off whatever's outstanding over a longer period of time. I will say something on behalf of lenders, if they're acting rationally, and of course often they didn't act rationally in the Great Recession, but for lenders, they generally take a really big hit when they put a home into foreclosure. So in other words, it's not a question of whether I'm a good guy or a bad guy or whatever, but if I have someone who hasn't paid their mortgage for the last 6 months, and I know it's because of the pandemic, so prior to that they're paying the mortgage and they've been reliable that way, I probably won't have to worry about going forward if they get back on their feet. But, you know, for the time being, they're 6 months or whatever behind in their mortgage. It's not a good move for me, just from the standpoint of the bottom line, to throw this person out and then suddenly have to put the home into foreclosure because there's all these legal costs, and then I put it on the market. And what's the market look like right now? Well, I can't speak for where you are, but in a lot of places around the country, including places like New York and San Francisco, prime real estate, prices have fallen through the floor. So you should expect that a lot of lenders will make arrangements with people who are behind in their mortgage. But again, that we can't assume they'll act rationally. And one of the big problems that we saw in the financial crisis was that the mortgage operations, there was basically no one there. This is something the Obama administration didn't seem to understand with their various HARP, and I forget what the others were, the HAMP HARP. They had two or three different plans to help homeowners, and they all depended on servicers working out deals. And they didn't understand. There literally was no servicer. There was someone who collected the check. And then if they didn't get the check, then after a month they sent out a threat of foreclosure. And then they sent another one after 2 months. And then if the person didn't make good on their past payments, they went in and started the procedure for foreclosure. But there literally was no one there who could work out, call up the homeowner and say, hey, what could you pay? What's the timeline? Let's work something out. I'm hoping that they're better today, but I wouldn't assume that they are. So I think in some cases, probably the mortgage operations are better so that they will be able to work it out. When I'm saying better, I'm not expecting them to be humanitarians. I expect them to be money-making operations. But they don't make money rushing through with a foreclosure and then putting a home on the market in the middle of a very severe recession and a real collapse in house prices it's probably not a good move for them if the alternative is to try to work out a repayment plan with a homeowner that they could do over 2 or 3 or 4 years.
I hope you're right.
I think they always lose money if they have to foreclose on a loan. At least that's what my dad used to say. You're always going to lose.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of research on that. It's a big loss to them. So they should not, if they could avoid that, they should want to avoid it. And again, in the financial crisis, the reason why, I mean, there would have been a lot of foreclosures in any case, don't get me wrong, but there were a lot of foreclosures that were done just because they were not set up to deal with some sort of adjustment to the mortgage that would have allowed the person to stay in their home.
We should say that Dean Baker was one of the people that predicted the mortgage crisis ahead of time, and you got some awards for your prediction. Go ahead, Klaus, but I would like to ask Dean, suppose, you know, Biden wins, the Democrats have the Senate, if we settle down to not a progressive situation, but a sane, reasonable situation, what should people do? I mean, what should be done to help the economy once the pandemic is past its peak?
Well, we really need an aggressive stimulus program, and this is where it's going to be very, very important. The Obama administration felt very concerned. A lot of people in the administration itself felt concerns about the deficits, but they're being pressured by people outside. We have to keep the deficit down. And really what they should have been thinking was the opposite. We have to spend a lot of money. We have to get the economy on its feet. And again, I was talking about global warming. We already knew back in 2009 global warming was a big problem. I mean, they did do something, so I don't want to say they did zero, but they should have done an order of magnitude more to try to get us towards a clean economy. And that's really going to have to be front and center, that the Biden administration is going to have to tell these deficit hawks, you guys are nuts. We need to spend money. We need to run large deficits. Because, again, getting back to that point I was saying before, here are all these jobs lost associated with the people going to work in downtown New York and San Francisco and other places. They're not in the restaurants. They're not driving the cabs, the Ubers. They're all these jobs are lost. So we have to find things for people to do. And those things are out there, but what that means is the federal government, at least for the near-term future, is going to have to run very large deficits to pay for these things.
And there's just no alternative to that. The government has to spend money to get us out of this.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, you're welcome to like the government or not like it, but there's nowhere else that spending's going to come from. So it's not going to be massive investment from the private sector, at least not unless the government lays the groundwork for it. So when the government lays the groundwork, say, you know, we do something like have charging stations for cars, well, that's going to help the sales of electric cars. I mean, you can think of a lot of other things like that, but it's not going to happen on its own. The government has a really big leadership role to play here, and they have the deep pockets at the end of the day. So the government could borrow, they could spend the money, and they really have to in this context.
Klaus, we can't see you. Can you get a question? Go ahead.
Well, a question or comment. I mean, it's very reminiscent of FDR and the New Deal, right? But the question that I had, real estate prices haven't really plummeted, though, have they?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, it's still early along in the game. So there is evidence. There are different companies that keep track of, when I'm saying keep track, like day-to-day track of prices in different cities. And I've seen New York and San Francisco prices are down somewhere around 5-7% from their peaks earlier in the year, which, yeah, you could pick your adjective, but that's a pretty sharp fall in a fairly short period of time. Is that going to continue? I don't know. But it's pretty striking because their real estate in those cities had been rising fairly rapidly and suddenly take a turn and fall 6-7%. That's a big deal. So, again, I don't know that you're seeing that everywhere. In fact, I'm sure you're not seeing that everywhere. But I think in a lot of areas you are seeing that. And in those areas, yeah, from the standpoint of a bank holding a mortgage, it probably would not be a smart move to rush ahead with a foreclosure and look to sell the home in a market where prices are plummeting.
I think the point you're making is very good, that this hasn't played out yet. We really don't know the full impact of the whole impact of COVID on the economy. I think it's important not to pretend that we understand it all and that we've got it all figured out.
Dean, let's do a nuts and bolts question. The next stimulus check, I believe you argued that the stimulus check isn't a good idea, but it's inevitable, probably politically. How much is the next stimulus check going to be?
Well, my guess is it probably will be the same as the last, $1,200 a person. Again, my reason for saying I don't think it's a good idea is I'm not sure what it's supposed to accomplish. I mean, the money for unemployed workers, of course, I understand. Money for food stamps, I understand. I'm not sure. You have a lot of people that are still at their jobs, a lot of retirees. They're happy to get $1,200, I'm sure, but I'm not sure what we think we're accomplishing with that. So I would look to see to have the money go to people who have been hurt. Also, another really big thing that has to be front and center is money for state and local governments. They've all taken a massive hit with lower tax collections due to the pandemic. They have huge increase in expenses associated with health care, other things they've had to do to try to make workplaces safe. The federal government's really been derelict in this, so state and local governments have had to step up insofar as anyone's doing it. And they don't have the money. So we have to give money to state and local governments to allow them to provide services and, of course, to avoid layoffs. We've already had 1.6 million layoffs at the state and local level. And if we don't get them a lot more money, we're going to see more. So those would be my priorities. And, the checks, it's not that I think they're necessarily a bad idea. It's just that if we think we're limited in how much we're going to spend, I'd hate to see us pay less in unemployment benefits or less money to state and local governments or less money for child care because we want to give people a $1,200 pandemic check.
All right. It's January 22nd. You're Joe Biden. You're sitting in the Oval Office. You're going to start doing executive orders because Trump sure showed us how to do that. And you said something about hundreds of executive orders he doesn't need. What executive orders does he start writing on January 22nd?
That's a really good question. Probably go through Trump's list and reverse half of them.
But
some of the things I would put front and center, I mean, one of the issues that's come up with the pandemic is the cost of drugs, cost of a vaccine. The government, the federal government, the president has the authority to use, I think it was 1498 of the Section 1498 of the Commercial Code. I could have my exact number wrong. But it allows him to essentially take a patent and put it in the public domain. And I would certainly do that with all the drugs and vaccines where the federal government has picked up the tab in funding during this crisis. It's absolutely mind-boggling to me that I'll pick on Moderna here because they've been the most visible. Government's paid them almost $1 billion to develop and test this vaccine. So we ordinarily give drug companies patent monopolies with the idea that that's going to give them incentive to do research and, of course, compensate them for the risk involved. In the case of Moderna, we paid for the research, and there was no risk in the event that we still don't know whether it will end up being a working vaccine, but they've already been paid. So the idea that if it does turn out to be a successful vaccine, we're then going to go around and pay them a second time and let them charge what they want with the patent monopoly, that's close to crazy. So I would love to see President Biden immediately take away that monopoly, put this in the public domain, let it be sold as a generic, let anyone who wanted to produce it, and we would pay a lot less money. And the same would be true for the other drugs and vaccines that have been developed basically on the public's dollar during this crisis. And I think that's important both because a lot of money is directly at stake, but it would set an important precedent because it makes the way we finance prescription drugs is absolutely crazy. And if people understood that if we just paid for the money up front, as we're doing in the case of Moderna, and then let them be sold at free market prices, we wouldn't have a problem paying for drugs.
Instead, we're paying on both ends. It's crazy. We're paying on both ends.
And it's funny because so few people understand that. I sometimes give talks on this, and I'll begin by saying drugs are cheap, and invariably people look at me like I'm an idiot. And I go, no, they're cheap to make. So there's, of course, expenses. The research is expensive, no doubt about it. But we would be so much better world if we just paid for the research up front. We already pay a lot. I mean, even Moderna is, of course, an extreme case. But we spend over $40 billion a year on biomedical research to the National Institutes of Health and other government agencies.
Wow.
So if we just paid for all the research and then we made the drugs available as cheap generics, we wouldn't have a problem with people struggling. How am I going to pay for this drug? Is it worth the money? you wouldn't ask those questions. You'd take the best drugs for your condition, and price really wouldn't be a factor because, again, in almost all cases, they're cheap to manufacture and distribute.
All right, that's Biden's first executive order, and a whole lot of problems with the way pharmaceuticals are handled.
That's a whole show.
That's many shows. Okay, what else should President Biden do January 22nd with an executive order?
Well, I live in southern Utah. One of the big issues Trump eviscerated two national monuments, Grand Escalante and Sleeping Bear.
Bear's Ears.
He basically cut them in half. And these are absolutely beautiful places, and they should be preserved, which is why they were national monuments to begin with. That's something that Trump cut them in half by executive order. Biden could restore them to their former status. It's still being contested in court, by the way, but this would make the court actions moot. There's a number of other things in the environmental area that Trump, of course, did by executive action. Biden could reverse by executive action, which will be very important. And, of course, Biden can go much, much further in terms of executive actions that will get us on a path towards a cleaner economy.
Now, you're a policy guy, and this is a sort of a personal question, but had you any idea that executive orders could be used? You know, and maybe you did, but most of us had no idea that executive orders could be used so widely and wantonly as we have been shown in the last 4 years.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not a constitutional law expert, but I think that Trump was able to use executive orders in a lot of cases where, say, President Obama would not have been, basically because he had a very partisan court. Obama was very cautious with executive orders. He began to use more of them the last 2 or 3 years of his presidency, but he was very, very cautious. And his view was that there's very limited room for the president to do things by executive order. And that may well have been true for him. Again, he would not have had as partisan accord as Donald Trump did. So what is, in some sense, the true domain for executive order? Again, you'd need a constitutional scholar to answer that, but I can just say, based on the historic record, presidents have historically felt that their authority to use executive orders was much, much less than Trump has exercised with his executive orders.
Right. It seemed like gumdrops to Trump. He could just munch on anything he wants.
All right. So how do we get back? How do we get an economy back real quick after this pandemic?
Well, I think the big thing is that we can't be afraid of running large deficits. That's going to be necessary. So short term, of course, things like unemployment insurance will have to top that out because the benefits in so many places are so low. Ideally, this can't be done immediately, but ideally we would federalize unemployment benefits. So you have very, very low benefits in places like Louisiana and Mississippi. They're somewhat more generous in, say, states like California and New York, but they've become very, very low. So we really have to raise those.
Arizona has one of the lowest in the nation by $240. I mean, you could be making $50,000 a week. You pay $240 a week. Now, we only got a couple minutes left, Dean, so I'm just giving you a little warning here.
Yeah, so as I say, unemployment benefits, work sharing is great policy. I've been pushing that for years. It's been it actually has bipartisan support. There's a lot of Republicans who support work sharing. Congress back in 2000, I guess it had been 11 or 12 when Boehner was Speaker, he supported work sharing. So that's a great way to keep people employed. So basically you encourage employers to reduce hours rather than lay people off. That's why a number of countries in Europe have seen very low increase in unemployment through this crisis.
Yeah,
so
Germany
that's something
and France
Biden should be pushing aggressively.
Yes. Great. Excellent.
And we can do all these things to get out. Are you basically optimistic that the COVID thing, that we'll be able to return to something like our old lifestyle and modified in some way?
I think so. I mean, I'm confident we'll have a vaccine. I've been following this very much as a non-expert, but I've been following the progress, not just of the U.S. vaccines, but in particular, China has three that are in phase three testing. And so far, they look very promising. So the idea that we won't have at least one vaccine that's pretty reliable, I think we could pretty much count on that. And then once we're in that world, most of us at least will be able to go out and not have to worry about getting the virus or giving it to someone close to us. And Yeah, I mean, that should mean we can get back to something like normal.
Excellent. We'll end on the vaccine note here. We've been talking to Dean Baker, a senior economist at the Center for Economic Policy Research. Folks, Democratic Perspective, we'll see you next time with another interesting show. Thank you.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.